Susan wasn't conscious, but if she were, she would have been insane with bloodlust. She nearly killed me the last time it had happened. It was sort of what had started this whole mess, in fact. Her body was covered in injuries of various sizes, and I thought I knew what was happening. It was instinctively drawing upon the vampire portion of her nature to restore her damaged flesh, but she had not provided that nature with sustenance. It could offer her only limited assistance. She needed blood. But if she got it, woke up, and decided that she just had to have more, yikes. Her breathing kept slowing. It caught for a moment, and I nearly panicked. Then I shook my head, took my penknife from my duster's pocket, and opened a cut in my left palm, in an area where the old burn scars were thickest, and which still didn't have a lot of sensitivity. I cupped my hand while I bled into my palm. Then, very carefully, I reached down and tipped it into Susan's mouth. You would have thought I'd just run a current of electricity through her body. She quivered, went rigid, and then arched her back into a bow. Strange popping sounds came from her back. Her empty black eyes opened and she gasped, then started blindly, trying to find my hand again with her mouth, the way a suckling baby finds its meals. I held my hand over her mouth and let the blood trickle in slowly. She surged in languid motion beneath my hand, savoring the blood as if it were chocolate, a massage, good sex, and a new car all rolled into one. 2 minutes of slow, dreamy, arching motion later, her eyes suddenly focused on me, and then narrowed. She snatched at my arm with her hands, and I drove my right fist into her face. I didn't pull the punch either. If her darker nature was allowed to continue, it would destroy her, killing me as a byproduct of the process. Her head snapped back against the ground, and she blinked her eyes, stunned. I stood up, took a few steps back, and stuffed my injured hand into my pocket. I was tired and feeling shocky. My whole arm felt cold. I didn't stop falling back until I was sure I could shield in time to hold her off if she came at me. I recognized it when Susan checked back in. Her breathing slowed, becoming controlled and steady. It took her 4 or 5 minutes of focus to push her darker self out of control, but eventually she did. She sat up slowly. She licked at her blood-stained lips and shuddered in slow ecstasy for a second, before dashing her sleeve across her mouth and forcing herself to her feet. She looked around wildly, a terrible dread in her eyes, until she spotted me. She stared at me for a moment and then closed her eyes. She whispered, "Thank God." I nodded to her and beckoned for her to stand at my side. I waited until she reached me. Then we both turned to face the Earl King. Off to one side, the members of the Red Court remained where they had been, save that this time Esteban and Esmeralda had been trapped in the goblins' nets as well. I had apparently been too intent on Susan to hear the sound of any struggle in the aftermath of the duel, but I could guess what had happened. As soon as the ick had begun to falter, they must have made a run for it. This time, though, they hadn't had the advantage of showing up in a totally unexpected place, with the goblins intent upon their meals. This time the goblins had taken them, probably before they had actually begun to flee. Both of the Ebes were staring at Susan and me with raw hatred written on their snarling faces. The Earl King looked at the captured vampires for a moment and smiled faintly. "Well fought," he said, his deep voice resonant. We both bowed our heads slightly to him. Then he lifted his hand and snapped his fingers once. It echoed like the report of a firearm. Screams went up from the helpless Red Court crew as several hundred violence-amped goblins fell on them in a wave. I watched for a moment in sickened fascination, but turned away. I hate the Red Court, but there are limits. The Earl King's kin had none. "What about the Red King?" I asked him. "The Lords of Outer Night?" His red eyes gleamed.
"His Majesty's folk failed to prove their peaceful intentions. The trial established their deception to the satisfaction of law and custom. Let him howl his fury if he so wills it. Should he begin a war over this matter, all of Faerie will turn upon him in outrage, and his people will make fine hunting. Beneath the screams of the Red Court, Esmeralda's were especially piercing, a ragged chuckle ran through the hall. The sound danced with its own echoes. It was like listening to the official soundtrack of hell. A goblin wearing thick leather gloves appeared, holding what was left of Susan's club as if it were red hot. The touch of iron and its alloys is an agony to the creatures of Faerie. Susan accepted the steel calmly, nodding to the gloved goblin.
"I presume, then," I said quietly, "that we are free to go."
"If I did not release you now," the Earl King said, his tone almost genial, "how should I ever have the pleasure of hunting you myself some fine, bright evening?" I hoped my gulp wasn't audible. The Lord of the Hunt turned and gestured idly with one hand, and a way shimmered into being behind us. The green light that had let us see began to darken rapidly.
"May you enjoy good hunting of your own, Sir Knight, Lady Huntress. Please convey my greetings to the Winter Queen."
My sane brain fell asleep at the switch, and I said,
"I will. It was a pleasure, Earl."
Maybe he didn't get it. He just tilted his head slightly, the way a dog does at a new sound.
We all bowed to one another politely, and Susan and I stepped through the way, careful not to take our eyes off of our host, until the world shimmered and that hall of horrors was gone. It was replaced with an enormous rustic-style building that appeared to be filled from the basement to the ceiling with everything you might possibly need to shoot, catch, find, stalk, hook, clean, skin, cook, and eat pretty much anything that ran, slithered, hopped, or swam.
"What the hell?" Susan said, looking around in confusion.
"Huh," I said. "This is the Bass Pro in Bolingbrook, I think. Makes sense, I guess."
"I didn't mean that," she said and pointed. "Look."
I followed her gaze to a large clock on the far wall of the big store. It said that the time was currently 9:30 p.m., 30 minutes after our departure time.
"How can that be?" Susan demanded. "We were there for half an hour at the most. Look, my watch says it's 2.
My heart began to beat faster.
"Hell's bells, I didn't even think of it."
"Of what?" I started walking. Susan ditched her club behind a shelf and followed me. We must have made a charming sight, both of us all scuffed up, torn, ragged, and wounded. A few late shoppers stared, but no one seemed willing to approach us.
"Time can pass at a different rate in the Never-Never than it does here," I said. "All those stories about people partying with the Fae overnight and waking up in a new century, that's why it happens."
The next link in the logic chain got forged, and I said, "Oh. Oh, damn it."
"What?"
Susan said.
"It's a 3-hour trip to Chichen Itza," I said quietly. "We can't get there by midnight."
Lead ingots began to pile up in my belly and on my shoulders and the back of my neck. I bowed my head, my mouth twisting bitterly.
We're too late.
Chapter 38.
"No," Susan said fiercely. "No. This isn't set up on Greenwich Mean Time, Harry. These creatures aren't performing their ceremony based on a clock. They're using the stars. We only know the approximate time. It could happen after midnight."
It could happen half an hour before midnight, I thought, but I didn't say that to Susan. Instead, I nodded. She was right. What she was saying just didn't feel right, but I knew, in my head, that she was on target. I forced myself to ignore that little whispering voice of defeat in my ear.
"Right," I said. "Right. Keep going. Maximum speed. We need to get back to St. Mary's and pick up everyone there."
Susan nodded and said, "Half an hour back if there's no traffic."
"And if you have a car," I said, "which we don't."
Susan's mouth twitched into a smile. "Good thing there's a whole parking lot full of them, then." I opened the front door for Susan, followed her out onto the sidewalk, and nearly got run over by an emerald green stretch limousine, its tail fins, elongated hood, and shining chrome grille marking it as something created in the extravagant years subsequent to the Second World War.
The limo screeched to a halt, and the driver, dressed in a no-nonsense black suit, got out and hurried around to the door nearest us. He was medium height, thin, young, and good-looking enough to be acting or modeling. So much so, in fact, that I decided immediately that he wasn't human. Almost as soon as I had the thought, I suddenly saw the young she-lord as he truly appeared, dressed in an emerald green tunic and tights, each with accents of deep violet. His sunny hair was bound back into a tight braid that fell past his waist, and his feline, cat-slitted amber eyes were piercing. He saw me staring and gave me a mocking little bow that only barely moved his head and chest, then opened the limo's door. The Lenanshi leaned over from the far side of the passenger compartment, an exasperated look on her face. "And here thou art at last, child. What madness possessed thee to pay a social call upon the hunter? He has a grudge against thee. Know you not what that means?" Susan tensed and took a step back from her. My godmother noticed it and favored her with a toothy smile. "Fear not, half-child. I've no reason to restrain thee again, unless, of course, thou wouldst like to see where it leads." She glanced up at the night sky, mostly hidden behind all the light pollution, and said, "Granted, we would be forced to indulge such curiosity another time."
"Godmother," I said, staring, "what a big car you have."
She shook a finger at me. "The better to take you to the house of the Weeping Mother, so that we may embark upon our quest, child. Glenmile, help them in, if you please. We race against time." The young she gestured gallantly toward the rear of the limo and offered me a supporting arm. I scowled at him, provoking another smiling bow of his head, and helped Susan into the car. I got in without help of my own, and in short order we found ourselves seated, facing the rear of the vehicle and my godmother, as the young she pulled out of the lot and headed for I-55.
"Ridiculous," Leah said, staring at me in disapproval. "You look utterly ridiculous."
I blinked at her and then down at myself. Okay, well, granted. I'd been smeared with ichor and then rolled around in the dirt and debris, and I had a bleeding cut on one hand, which does not for neatness make. My jeans were a wreck, my t-shirt was beyond repair and going to get cut up for rags, and even my duster looked dirty and strained. Susan wasn't in much better condition. "I'm not going to a state dinner, Godmother," I said. Her voice turned wry.
"That depends upon who wins the battle, methinks."
She looked me up and down and shook her head.
"No, no, it won't do at all.
My queen has a certain reputation to maintain, after all. Your first engagement as the Winter Knight calls for something a bit less post-apocalyptic." She studied Susan with a critical expression.
"Hmm. And your concubine cannot be allowed to bring any shame upon you, and by extension, upon the queen."
I sputtered. Susan arched an eyebrow.
"His concubine? His lover? The mother of his child, yet to whom he has not wed? I believe the term applies, dear."
She waved a hand.
"Words. La. Let us see."
She rested a fingertip thoughtfully upon the end of her nose, staring at me. Then she said,
"Let us begin with silk."
She murmured a word, passed her hand over me, and my clothes started writhing as if they'd been made out of a single flat organism, and one that hadn't yet had the courtesy to expire. It was the damnedest feeling, and I hit my head on the roof of the limo as I jumped in surprise. A few seconds later, clenching my head, I eyed my godmother and said,
"I don't need any help."
"Harry,"
Susan said in a strangled voice. She was staring at me. I looked down and found myself garbed in silken clothing. My shirt had become a billowing affair of deep gray silk, fitted close to my torso by a rather long vest of midnight black, seated in patterns of deep amethysts, green-blue opals, and pale, exquisite pearls. The tights were also made of silk, closely fit and pure white, while the leather boots that came up to my knees were the same deep gray as the shirt. I stared at me, then at Susan.
"Wow," Susan said. You really do have a fairy godmother."
"And I've never been able to indulge," Leah said, studying me absently.
"This won't do."
She waved her hand again.
"Perhaps a bit more..."
My clothing writhed again, the sensation so odd and intrusive that I all but banged my head on the roof again. We went through a dozen outfits in half as many minutes. A Victorian suit and coat, complete with tails, was nixed in favor of another silk outfit, this one inspired by Imperial China. By then, Susan and Leah were actively engaged in the project, exchanging commentary with each other and ignoring absolutely every word that came out of my mouth. By the seventh outfit, I had given up trying to have any say whatsoever in how I was going to be dressed. I was given outfits drawing inspiration from widely diverse cultures and periods of history. I lobbied for the return of my leather duster stridently, but Leah only shushed me and kept speaking to Susan. "Which outfit is really going to get that bitch's goat?" Susan asked her. Finally, Leah's mouth curled up into a smile, and she said, "Perfect." My clothes writhed one more time, and I found myself dressed in ornate Gothic armor of the style used in Western Europe in the 15th century. It was black and articulated, with decorated shoulder pauldrons and an absurdly ornate breastplate. Gold filigree was everywhere, and the thing looked like it should weigh 600 pounds. "Cortez wore armor in just this style," Leah murmured. She studied my head and said, "Though it needs..." A weight suddenly enclosed my head. I sighed patiently and reached up to remove the conquistador's helmet decorated to match the armor. I put it down on the floor of the limo and said firmly, "I don't do hats." "Pooh," Leah said. "Ariana still hates the Europeans with a vengeance, you know. It was why she took a conquistador husband." I blinked. "Ortega?" "Of course, child," Leah said. "Love and hate are oft difficult to distinguish between. She won Ortega's heart, changed him, wed him, and spent the centuries after breaking his heart over and over again, calling for him and then sending him away, giving in to him and then reversing her course. She said it kept her hatred fresh and hot."
"Explains why he was working in bloody Brazil," I said.
"Indeed." "Hmm." She flicked a hand and added a Roman-style cloak of dark gray to my armor-broadened shoulders, its ties fastened to the front of the breastplate. Another one changed the style of my boots slightly. She added a deep hood to the cloak. Then she thoughtfully wrought all the gold on the armor into a spectrum of color that changed from natural gold to a green that deepened along the color gradient to blue and then purple the farther it went from my face, giving the gold filigree a cold, eerily surreal look. She added front panels to the cloak so that it fell like some kind of robe in the front, belted to my waist with a sash of deep, dark purple. A final adjustment made the armor over my shoulders a bit wider and thicker, giving me that football shoulder pad profile I remembered from Friday nights in high school. I looked down at myself and said, "This is ridiculous. I look like the Games Workshop version of a Jedi Knight." Susan and Leah blinked at me, then at each other. "I want my duster back, damn it," I clarified.
"That old rag," Leah said. "You have an image to maintain."
"And I'm gonna maintain it in my duster," I said stubbornly.
"Harry," Susan said. "She might have a practical point here."
I eyed her, then my outfit. "Practical?"
"Appearances and first impressions are powerful things," she said. "Used correctly, they're weapons in their own right."
"I don't know about you, but I want every weapon I can get,"
Leah murmured. "Indeed."
"Okay. I don't see why my image can't wear my duster. We need to be quick, too. This getup is going to be binding and heavier than hell."
Leah's mouth curled up at one corner.
"Oh?"
I scowled at her. Then I shook my shoulders and twisted about a bit. There was a kind of springy flexibility to the base material of the armor that steel would never match. More to the point, now that I was actually moving about, I couldn't feel its weight. At all. I might as well have been wearing comfortable pajamas.
"No mortal could cut through it by strength of mundane arms," she said calmly. "It will shed blows from even such creatures as the vampires of the Red Court, for a time, at least. And it should help you shield your mind against the wills of the lords of outer night."
"Should?" I asked. "What do you mean, should?"
"They are an ancient power, godchild," Leah replied and gave me her cat's smile again.
I have not had the opportunity to match my new strength against theirs.
She looked me up and down one more time and nodded, satisfied.
You look presentable. Now, child, she said, turning to Susan, let us see what we might do for you.
Susan handled the whole thing a lot better than I had. I got distracted while they were working. I looked out the window and saw us blowing past a highway patrol car as if it were standing still, instead of racing down the highway with its bulbs flashing and its siren wailing. We had to be doing triple digits to have left them eating our dust so quickly. The patrolman didn't react to our passage, and I realized that Glenn Mile must be hiding the car behind some kind of veil. He was also, I noticed, weaving and darting through the traffic with entirely impossible skill, missing other motorists' bumpers and fenders by inches, with them apparently none the wiser. Not only that, but I couldn't feel the motion at all within the passenger compartment. By all rights, we should have been bouncing off the windows and the roof, but it didn't feel as if the car were moving at all. Long story short, he got us to St. Mary's in less than 15 minutes, and gave me several dozen new gray hairs in the process. We pulled up, and Glenn Mile was opening the door to the rear compartment at seemingly the same instant that the car's weight settled back against its parking brakes. I got out, the dark gray cowl covering my head. My shadow, on the sidewalk in front of me, looked freaking huge and scary. Irrationally, it made me feel a little better. I turned to help Susan out, and felt my mouth drop open a little. Her outfit was, freaking hot. The golden headdress was the first thing I noticed. It was decorated with feathers, with jade, carved with sigils and symbols like those I had seen on the stone table, and with flickering gems of arctic green and blue. For a second, I thought her vampire nature had begun to rise again, because her face was covered in what I mistook for tattoos. A second glance showed me that they were some kind of precisely drawn design, sort of like henna markings, but far more primitive and savage-looking in appearance. They were also done in a variety of colors of black and deep, dark red. The designs around her dark brown eyes made them stand out sharply. Under that, she wore a shift of some material that looked like simple, soft buckskin, split at the hips for ease of movement, and her feet were wrapped in shoes made of similar material, also decorated with feathers. The moccasins and shift both were pure white, and made a sharp contrast against the dark richness of her skin, and displayed the smooth, tight muscles of her arms and legs tremendously well. A belt of white leather had an empty holster for a handgun on one of her hips, with a frog for hanging a scabbard upon it on the other. And over all of that, she wore a mantled cloak of feathers, not too terribly unlike the ones we had seen in Nevada, but the colors were all in the rich, cool tones of the winter court, glacial blue, deep sea green, and twilight purple. She looked at me and said, "I'm waiting for you to say something about a Vegas showgirl." It took me a moment to reconnect my mouth to my brain. "You look amazing," I said. Her smile was slow and hot, with her dark eyes on mine. I said, "but it doesn't look very practical." Leah accepted Glenn Miles' hand and exited the limo. She leaned over and murmured something into Susan's ear. Susan arched an eyebrow, but then said, "Okay." She closed her eyes briefly, frowning. And she vanished, like completely. Not behind a hard-to-pierce veil, just gone. My godmother laughed and said, "The same as before, but red, child." "Okay," said Susan's voice from empty air, and suddenly she was back again, smiling broadly. "Wow." "The cloak will hide you from the eyes and other senses as well, child," my godmother said. "And while you wear those shoes, your steps will leave no tracks nor make the smallest sound."
Right, I said. "But I'd feel better if she had some Kevlar along or something, just in case."
"Glenn Mile?" said my godmother. The chauffeur calmly drew a 9mm, pointed it at Susan's temples from point-blank range, and squeezed the trigger. The gun barked. Susan jerked her head to one side and staggered, clapping one hand to her ear.
"Ow!"
she snarled, rising and turning on the young she.
"You son of a bitch! Those things are loud! That hurt!"
I'd have kicked your ass up between your ears for you.
In answer, the Shi bent with consummate grace and plucked something from the ground. He stood and showed it to Susan, and then to me. It was a bullet. The nose was smashed in flat until it vaguely resembled a small mushroom.
Our eyes got kind of wide.
Leah spread her hands and said calmly, "Fairy godmother." I shook my head, stunned. It had taken me years to design, create, and improve my leather duster's defensive spells, and even then, the protection extended only as far as the actual leather. Leah had whipped up a whole body protective enchantment in minutes. I suddenly felt a bit more humble. It was probably good for me. But then I tilted my head, frowning. The power involved in my godmother's gifts was incredible. But the universe just doesn't seem to be willing to give you something for nothing. That was as true in magic as it was in physics. I could, with years of effort, probably duplicate what Leah's gifts did. The Shi worked with the same magic I did, though, admittedly, they seemed to have a very different sort of relationship. Still, that much power, all in one spot, meant that the energy cost for it was being paid elsewhere. Like, maybe in longevity. "Godmother," I asked, "how long will these gifts endure?" Her smile turned a little sad. "Ah, child, I am a fairy godmother, am I not? Such things are not meant to last."
"Don't tell me midnight," I said.
"Of course not. I am not part of summer," she sniffed rather scornfully. "Noon." And that made more sense. My duster's spells lasted for months, and I thought I'd worked out how to make them run for more than a year the next time I laid them down. Leah's gifts involved the same kind of power output, created seemingly without toil, but they wouldn't last like the things I created would. My self-image recovered a little. "Leah," I asked, "did you bring my bag?" Glenmile opened the trunk and brought it over to me. The swords in their scabbards were still strapped to the bag's side. I picked it up and nodded. "Thanks." He bowed, smiling. I was tempted to tip him just to see what would happen, but then I remembered that my wallet had been in my blue jeans and was now, presumably, part of the new outfit. Maybe it would reappear at noon tomorrow, assuming I was alive to need it, I mean. "I will wait here," Leah said. "When you are ready to travel to the First Way, Glenmile will take us there."
"Right," I said. "Let's go, princess."
"Of course, Sir Knight," Susan said, her eyes sparkling, and we went into the church.
Chapter 39. Sonya was guarding the door. He swung it open wide for us and studied Susan with a grin of appreciation.
"There are some days," he said, "when I just love this job."
"Come on," I said, walking past him. "We don't have much time."
Sonya literally clicked his heels together, took Susan's hand, and kissed the back of it gallantly, the big stupid head.
"You are beyond lovely, lady."
"Thank you," Susan said, smiling, "but we don't have much time." I rolled my eyes and kept walking. There was a quiet conversation going in the living room. It stopped as I came through the door. I paused there for a second and looked around at everyone who was going to help me get my daughter back. Molly was dressed in her battle coat, which consisted of a shirt of tightly woven metal links fashioned by her mother out of titanium wire. The male was then sandwiched between two long Kevlar vests. All of that was, in turn, fixed to one of several outer garments, and in this case she was wearing a medium brown fireman's coat. Her hair was braided tightly against the back of her head and back to its natural honey brown color, and a hockey helmet sat on a table near her. She had half a dozen little focus items I'd shown her how to create, none of which were precisely intended for a fight. Her face was a little pale, and her blue eyes were earnest. Mouse sat next to her, huge and stolid, and rose to his feet and padded over to give me a subdued greeting as I came in. I knelt down and roughed up his ears for a moment. He wagged his tail, but made no more display than that, and his serious brown eyes told me that he knew the situation was grave. Next came Martin, dressed in simple black BDU pants, a long-sleeved black shirt, and a tactical vest, all of which could have been purchased from any military surplus or gun store. He was in the midst of cleaning and inspecting two sets of weapons, assault rifles, tactical shotguns, and heavy pistols. He wore a machete and a scabbard on his belt. A second such weapon rested in a nylon sheath on the table next to a blade-sharpening toolkit. He never looked up at me or stopped reassembling the pistol he'd finished cleaning. A small chess set had been set up on the other end of the coffee table from Molly, next to Martin's war gear. My brother sat there, with Martin, and once he had finished greeting me, Mouse, between himself and the girl. He was wearing expensive-looking silk pants and a leather vest, both white. A gun belt, bearing a large-caliber handgun and a sword with an inward-curving blade, an old Spanish falcata, hung over the corner of the couch, casually discarded. He lay lazily back on the couch, his eyes mostly closed, watching the move of his opponent. Murphy was decked out in black tactical gear much like Martin's, but more worn and better fitting. They don't generally make gear for people Murph's size, so she couldn't chop off the shelf very often. She did have her own vest of Kevlar and mail, which Charity had made for her for Christmas the previous year, in thanks for the occasions when Murphy had gone out on a limb for them, but Murph had just stuck them to her tack vest and been done. She wore her automatic on her hip, and her odd-looking rectangular little submachine gun, the one that always made me think of a box of chocolates, was leaned against the wall nearby. Murph was hunched over the chessboard, her nose wrinkled as she thought, and moved one of her knights into a thicket of enemy pieces before she turned to look at me. She took one look at me and burst out giggling. That was enough to set off everyone in the room except Martin, who never seemed to realize that there were other people there. Molly's titters set off Thomas, and even Mouse dropped his jaws open in a doggy grin. "Ha, ha, ha," I said, coming into the room, so that Susan and Sonya could join us. No one laughed at Susan's outfit. I felt that the injustice of that was somehow emblematic of the unfairness in my life. But I didn't have time to chase that thought down and feed it rhetoric until the light bulb over my head lit up. "Well," Murphy said as the laughter died away, "I'm glad you got out all right. Went shopping after, did you?" "Not so much," I said. "Okay, listen up, folks. Time is short. What else did we manage to find out about the site?" Murphy told Thomas, "Mate in six," took a file folder from beneath her chair and passed it to me. "You wish," Thomas drawled lazily. I eyed him and opened the folder. There were multiple pages inside, color aerial and satellite photos of the ruins. "Good grief," I said. "How did you get these?" "Internet," Murphy said calmly. "We've got an idea of where they're setting up and what security measures they'll need to take, but before we can talk about an approach, we need to know where we're going to arrive." I stroked a thumb over my mother's gem and consulted the knowledge stored there. Then I went through the maps until I found one of the proper scale, picked up a pen from the table, and drew an X on the map. "Here, it's about 5 miles north of the pyramid." Thomas whistled quietly. "What?" I asked him. "You can't do 5 miles?"
5 miles of sidewalk, sure," Thomas said. 5 miles of jungle is a bit different, Dresden."
"He's right," Martin said. "And at night, too." Thomas spread his hands.
"I've done a little jungle," Sonya said, coming over to study the map. "How bad is the bush there?"
"Tougher than the lower Amazon. Not as bad as Cambodia," Martin said calmly. Sonya grunted. Thomas wrinkled his nose in distaste. I tried to pretend that Martin had given me some kind of tangible information, and idly wondered if Thomas and Sonya were doing the same thing as me.
"How long, Martin?" I asked him.
2 hours, bare minimum. Could be more, depending." I grunted, then I said, "We'll see if Leah can't do something to help us along." The room went still.
Murphy said, "Your psycho fairy godmother? That Leah?"
"Harry, you told me she was dangerous," Molly said.
"And I still have the scar to prove it," Thomas added.
"Yes," I said quietly. "She's powerful, and by any reasonable standard, she's insane. And she's currently pointed in the direction of our enemy, so we're going to use her."
"We're using her, are we?" Sonya asked, grinning.
He told us what Toot said about Mab, Harry, Molly said softly.
There was a long stretch of quiet.
You made a deal, Murphy said.
Yeah, I did. For Maggie, I did. I looked around the room. I'm me until this is all over. That was part of the deal. But if there's anyone here who wants to bail on me and Susan, do it now. Otherwise, feel free to keep your mouth closed about the subject. My daughter doesn't have time for us to debate the ethics of a choice that isn't any of your goddamn business anyway. I looked around the room and Sonya said, I am going. Who else goes with us? Mouse sneezed. I figured that, I told him. He wagged his tail. Me, obviously, Martin said. Murphy nodded. Molly did, too. Then Thomas rolled his eyes. Good, I said. Leah will probably have something to shorten the trip, I said. She'd better, Thomas said. Time's short. We will be there in time, Sonya said confidently. I nodded. Then I said, And I have a favor to ask two of you. I put the bag down and pulled Phidolochius from where I'd tied it. The ancient katana-style sword had a smooth wooden handle that perfectly matched the wood of its sheath, so that when the weapon was sheathed, it looked innocuous, appearing to be a slightly curved, sturdy stick of a good size to carry while walking. The blade was razor-sharp. I had dropped a plastic drinking straw across it as an experiment once. The rate of fall had been all the exquisite weapon had needed to slice the straw neatly in half. Karen, I said, and held out the sword. Sonya's eyebrows climbed toward the roof.
I've been offered that sword before, Harry, she said quietly. Nothing's changed since then.
I'm not asking you to take up the mantle of a knight, I said quietly. I want to entrust it to you for this night, for this purpose. This sword was made to fight darkness, and there's going to be plenty to go around. Take it up. Just until my girl is safe.
Murphy frowned. She looked at Sonya and said, Can he do this?
Can you? Sonya asked, looking at me. I was entrusted as the sword's guardian, I said calmly. Exactly what am I supposed to do with it if it is not my place to choose the sword's bearer to the best of my ability?
Sonya considered that for a moment, then shrugged.
Seems implicit to me. They gave you the power of choice when they entrusted you with the swords. One of those things they seem to tell you without ever actually saying anything that sounds remotely related.
I nodded. Murph, used for the right reasons, in good faith, the sword is in no danger. You're the only one who can know if you're doing it for the right reasons. But I'm begging you, take it. Help me save my daughter, Karen. Please.
Murphy sighed. You don't play fair, Harry.
Not for one second, I said. Not for something like this.
Murphy was quiet for a moment more. Then she stood up and walked to me. She took the sword from my hand. There was an old cloth strap fixed to its sheath, so that the weapon could be carried over one shoulder or diagonally across the back. Murphy slipped the weapon on and said, I'll carry it. If it seems right to me, I'll use it.
That's all I can ask for, I said.
Then I picked up Amorakius, a European longsword with a crusader-style hilt and a simple wire-wrapped handle. And I turned to Susan. She stared at me and then shook her head slowly.
The last time I touched one of those things, she said, it burned me so bad I could still feel it 3 months later.
That was then, I said. This is now. You're doing what you're doing because you love your daughter. If you stay focused on that, this sword will never do you harm.
I turned the hilt to her.
Put your hand on it.
Susan did so, slowly, almost as if against her will. She hesitated at the last moment, then her fingers closed on the blade. And that was all. Nothing happened.
Swear to harm no innocence, I said quietly. Swear to use it in good faith, to return your daughter safely home. Swear that you will safeguard the sword and return it faithfully when that task is done. And I don't see any reason why you shouldn't be able to wield it.
She met my eyes and nodded.
I swear.
I nodded in reply and took my hands from the weapon. Susan drew it slightly from its sheath. Its edge gleamed, and its steel was polished as smooth and bright as a mirror. And when she moved to buckle it to her belt, the sword fit there, as if made for it. My godmother was probably going to feel very smug about that.
I hope that the Almighty will not feel slighted if I carry more, innovative weaponry as well, Susan said.
She crossed to the table, slid one of Martin's revolvers into her holster, and after a moment picked up the assault rifle. Sonya stepped forward as well, and took the tactical shotgun with its collapsible shoulder stock.
If he exists, he has never given me any grief about it, he said cheerfully. Bah, this is going very well already.
Thomas barked out a laugh. There are 7 of us against the Red King and his 13 most powerful nobles, and it's going well? Mouse sneezed. 8, Thomas corrected himself. He rolled his eyes and said, And the Psycho Death Fairy makes it 9.
It's like movie, Sonya said, nodding. Dibs on Legolas.
Are you kidding? Thomas said. I'm obviously Legolas. You're... He squinted thoughtfully at Sonya, and then at Martin.
Well, he's Boromir, and you're clearly Aragorn.
Martin is so dour. He's more like Gimli.
Sonya pointed at Susan.
Her sword is much more like Aragorn's.
Aragorn wishes he looked that good, countered Thomas.
What about Karin? Sonya asked.
What, for Gimli? Thomas mused.
She is fairly... Finish that sentence, Wraith, and we throw down, said Murphy in a calm, level voice.
Tough, Thomas said, his expression aggrieved. I was going to say tough. Martin had gotten up during the discussion. He came over to me and studied the map I'd marked. Then he nodded. As the discussion went on, with Molly's sponsorship, Mouse was lobbying to claim Gimli on the basis of being the shortest, the stoutest, and the hairiest. Martin explained what they knew of the security measures around the ruins.
That's why we're going in here, he said, pointing to the easternmost point of the ruins, where rows and rows and rows of great columns stood.
Once they had held up some kind of roof over a complex attached to the great temple. Now, Martin continued, the jungle has swallowed the eastern end of it. They're only using torchlight, so movement through the gallery should be possible. There will be considerable shadow to move through.
Means they'll have guards there, I said.
True. We'll have to silence them. It can be done. If we can move fully through the galleries, we'll be within 200 feet of the base of the temple. That's where we think they'll be performing the ritual, in the temple.
Plenty of temples got built on top of ley line confluences, I said, nodding. I studied the map. A lot can happen in 200 feet, I said, even moving fast.
Martin nodded.
Yes, it can. And if our various intelligence sources are correct, there are more than 1,000 individuals nearby.
1,000 vampires? I asked. Martin shrugged.
Many. Many will be their personal guards. Others, the highest-ranking servants, I suppose you would call them. They are like Susan and myself. There may also be mortal foot soldiers, there to keep the sacrifices in line.
Sacrifices? Plural?
Martin nodded. The ceremonies of the Red Court of old could last for days, with blood sacrifices made every few minutes. There might be 100 or 200 others chosen to die before the ritual. I didn't shudder, but only by sheer force of will.
Yeah, priming the pump, I nodded. Probably they're doing it right now.
Yes, Martin said.
What we need, I said.
A diversion, Martin said.
I nodded. Get everyone looking in one direction. Then Susan, Leah, and I will hit the temple, get the kid. Then we all run for Father Fort Hill's sanctuary on holy ground. They'll catch us long before we can cover that distance.
You ever tried chasing a fairy through the woods at night? I asked wryly.
Trust me, if we can break contact, we can make it a few miles.
Why not retreat directly to the spirit world? Martin asked.
I shook my head. No way. Creatures this old and powerful know all the tricks there, and they'll be familiar with the terrain on the other side that close to their strong places. I won't fight them on that ground unless there's no other choice. We head for the church.
I pointed to the location of the church, in a small town only about 2.5 miles from Chichen Itza. Martin smiled faintly. Do you honestly think a parish chapel will withstand the might of the Red King? I have to think that, Martin, I said. Besides, I think a parish chapel with all 3 swords defending it, along with 2 members of the White Council and an elder sorceress of the Winter She, will be a tough nut to crack. And all we have to do is make it until dawn. Then we're back in the jungle and gone. Martin mused on that for a moment and said, It might work.
Yeah, it might, I said. We need to move. Our ride is outside waiting.
Right. Martin looked at Susan and nodded. Then he put his fingers to his mouth and let out a piercing whistle. The good-natured discussion came to a halt, and he said, The car's outside.
Let's go, people, I said quietly. It's the big green car outside.
Everyone grew serious rather rapidly and began gathering up their various forms of gear. Susan went out first to make sure there weren't any problems with Leah, and everyone filed out after her, Sonya last.
Sonya, I said, who did I get cast as?
Sam, Sonya said.
I blinked at him.
Not... Oh, for crying out loud, it was perfectly obvious who I should have been.
Sonya shrugged. It was no contest. They gave Gandalf to your godmother. You got Sam.
He started to leave, and then paused.
Harry, you have read the books as well, yes?
Sure, I said.
Then you know that Sam was the true hero of the tale, Sonya said. That he faced far greater and more terrible foes than he ever should have had to face, and did so with courage. That he went alone into a black and terrible land, stormed a dark fortress, and resisted the most terrible temptation of his world for the sake of the friend he loved. That in the end, it was his actions, and his actions alone, that made it possible for light to overcome darkness.
I thought about that for a second, then I said, Oh.
He clapped me on the shoulder and left. He didn't mention the other part of the book, that following the heroes when they set out was the 10th member of their party. A broken creature who went through all the same dangers and trials, who had made a single bad choice and taken up a power he didn't understand, and who had become a demented, miserable, living nightmare because of it. In the end, he had been just as necessary to the overthrow of the darkness. But he sure as hell didn't enjoy his part. I shook my head and berated myself sharply. Here I was wasting time talking about a damn book, about a world of blacks and whites with precious little in the way of gray, where you could tell the good guys from the bad guys with about 2 seconds of effort. And right now, I didn't give a damn about good and bad. I just wanted a little girl home safe. It didn't matter which of them I was, as long as I got Maggie home. I picked up my bag, left St. Mary's behind me, and stalked out to my wicked godmother's limo, pulling the soft hood of my dark cape up over my head. If I was on the road to hell, at least I was going in style.
Chapter 40.
There was room for everyone in the back of the limo. I was pretty sure that there hadn't been the first time I'd ridden in it, but it had gotten several extra feet of seats along the walls, and everyone was sitting there being only a little bit crowded as Glenn Mile charged out to assault Chicago's streets.
I still think we should try a frontal assault, Sonya argued.
Suicidally stupid, Martin said, his voice scornful.
Surprise tactic, Sonya countered. They will never expect it after 1,000 years of never being challenged. Harry, what do you think?
I said.
And then Ebenezer's voice said, quite clearly and from no apparent source,
Damn your stubborn eyes, boy. Where have you been?
I went rigid with surprise for a second. I looked around the interior of the limo, but no one had reacted, with the exception of my godmother. Leah sighed and rolled her eyes. Right. The speaking stones. I'd stuck mine in the bag, but since I was holding it on my lap now, it was close enough to be warmed by the heat of my body to function.
It was possible to send terse messages through the stones without first establishing a clear connection, as my mentor and I had done back toward the beginning of this mess.
"Damnation and hellfire, hoss," growled Ebenezer's voice. "Answer me."
I looked from Sonya to my godmother. I kind of have to take this call. Sonya blinked at me. Thomas and Murphy exchanged a significant glance.
Oh, shut up, I said crossly. It's magic, okay?
I closed my eyes and fumbled through the bag until I found the stone. I didn't really need to show up in my outlandish costume for this conversation, so I thought about my own physical body for a moment, concentrating on an image of my limbs and flesh and normal clothing forming around my thoughts.
So help me, boy, if you don't...
Ebenezer appeared in my mind's eye, wearing his usual clothing. He broke off suddenly as he looked at me, and his face went pale.
Hoss, are you all right?
Not really, I said. I'm kind of in the middle of something here. What do you want?
Your absence from the conclave did not go over well, he responded, his voice sharp. There are people in the Grey Council who think you ought to be trusted. They are very, very wary of you. By missing the meeting, you told them that either you don't respect our work enough to bother showing up, or else that you don't have the wisdom and the fortitude to commit to the cause.
I never saw the appeal of peer pressure, I said.
Sir, I'm finding a little girl. I'll come play council politics after I get her home safe if you want.
We need you here.
The kid needs me more. It's not as noble as trying to save the whole white council from its own stupidity, I know, but by God, I will bring that child out safe.
Ebenezer's mostly bald pate flushed red.
Despite my orders to the contrary.
We aren't an army. You aren't my superior officer, sir.
You arrogant child, he snapped. Get your head out of your ass and get your eyes on the world around you, or you're going to get yourself killed.
With all due respect, sir, you can go to hell, I snarled. You think I don't know how dangerous the world is, me?
I think you're doing everything in your power to isolate yourself from the only people who can support you, he said. You feel guilty about something. I get that, Hoss. You think you ain't fit for company because of what you've done. His scowl darkened still more. In my time, I've done things that would curl your hair. Get over it. Think.
After I get the girl out.
Do you even know where she is? Ebenezer demanded.
Chichen Itza, I said. She's scheduled to be the centerpiece of one of the Red King's shindigs in the next couple of hours.
Ebenezer took a sharp breath, as if I'd poked him in the stomach with the end of a quarterstaff.
Chichen Itza? That's a confluence. One of the biggest in the world. The Reds haven't used it in... not since Cortez was there.
Confluence, yeah, I said. The Duchess Ariana is going to kill her and use the power to lay a curse on her bloodline, Susan and me.
Ebenezer began to speak and then blinked several times, as if the sun had just come out of a cloud and into his eyes.
Susan and...
He paused and asked,
Hoss?
I meant to tell you the last time we spoke, I said quietly. But the conversation wasn't exactly... I took a deep breath. She's my daughter, by Susan Rodriguez.
Oh,
he said very quietly. His face looked gray.
Oh, Hoss.
Her name's Maggie. She's 8. They took her a few days ago. He bowed his head and shook it several times, saying nothing. Then he said,
You're sure?
Yeah.
How long have you known?
Since a day or so after she was taken, I said. Surprised the hell out of me. Ebenezer nodded without looking up. Then he said,
You're her father, and she needs you. And you want to be there for her.
Not want to be there, I said quietly. Going to be.
Aye,
he said.
Don't go back to the Edinburgh facility. We think Ariana laced it with some kind of disease while she was there. So far there are 60 wizards down with it, and we're expecting more. No deaths yet, but whatever this bug is, it's putting them flat on their backs, including Injun Joe, so our best healer isn't able to work on the problem.
Hell's bells, I said. They aren't just starting back in on the war again. They're going to try to decapitate the council in one blow. Ebenezer grunted.
Aye. And without the Way Nexus around Edinburgh, we're going to have a hell of a time with that counterstroke. He sighed. Hoss, you got a damn big talent. Not real refined, but you've matured a lot in the past few years. Handle yourself better in a fight than most with a couple of centuries behind them. Wish you could be with us.
I wasn't sure how to feel about that. Ebenezer was generally considered the heavyweight champion of the wizarding world when it came to direct face-to-face mayhem. And I was one of the relatively few people who knew he was also the Black Staff, the White Council's officially non-existent hitman, authorized to ignore the laws of magic when he deemed it necessary. The old man had fought pretty much everything that put up a fight at one point or another, and he didn't make a habit of complimenting anyone's skills.
I can't go with you, I said.
Aye, he said with a firm nod. You do whatever you have to do, boy. Whatever you have to do to keep your little girl safe. You hear?
Yeah, I said. Thank you, sir.
Godspeed, son, Ebenezer said, and he cut the connection. I released my focus slowly until I was back in my body in the back of the limo.
Who was it? Molly asked.
The others let her take the lead. She must have explained the whole speaking stone concept to them, which made me look less crazy, but I felt twitchy about her handing out information like that to the entire car. It wasn't a big deadly secret or anything, but it was the principle of the thing that... I rubbed my face with one hand. Ye gods, I was becoming my mentors. Next I'd be grumbling about those darn kids and their loud music. The council, I said. Big shock. They aren't helping. Murphy looked like she might be asleep, but she snorted.
So, we're on our own.
Yeah.
Good. It's more familiar.
Leah let out a peal of merry laughter. Murphy opened an eye and gave Leah a decidedly frosty look.
What?
You think that this is like what you've done before, my godmother said. So precious.
Murphy stared at her for a moment and then looked at me.
Harry?
I leaned my head back against the window so that the hood fell over my eyes. Murphy was way too good at picking up on it when I lied.
I don't know, I said. I guess we'll see.
It took Glen Mile less than 20 minutes to get to Aurora. We got out at a park there, a pretty little community place. It was empty this time of night, and all the lights were out. Pitcher's mound, folks, I said, piling out and taking the lead. I was walking with long, long strides, staying ahead of everyone. Murphy caught up to me, moving at a slow jog.
Harry, she said, her voice low. Your godmother?
Yeah.
Can we trust her?
I scowled. She wouldn't be able to see the expression with the hood and all. Do you trust me?
Why do you think I'm asking you?
I thought about it for a moment and then slowed down so that everyone else was nearer. That included my godmother.
Okay, folks, let's clear the air about the scary she-lady. She's under orders to go with me and to help. She will. She's got a vested interest in making sure I come out of this all right, and if she doesn't do it, she's in trouble with the Queen. As long as you are all helpful to her mission, getting me in and out in one piece, she'll support you. The second she thinks you're a liability or counterproductive to her mission, she's going to let bad things happen to you, maybe even do them herself. I looked at Leah. Is that about right?
That is precisely right, she said, smiling.
Susan arched an eyebrow and looked from me to my godmother.
You have no shame about it at all, do you?
Shame, child, is for those who fail to live up to the ideal of what they believe they should be.
She waved her hand.
It was shame that drove me to my queen to beseech her aid.
Her long, delicate fingers idly moved to the streaks of white in her otherwise flawless red tresses.
But she showed me the way back to myself, through exquisite pain. And now I am here to watch over my dear godson, and the rest of you, as long as it is quite convenient.
Spooky death she-lady, Molly said. Now upgraded to spooky, crazy death she-lady.
The Lenanshi bared her canine teeth in a fox-like smile.
Bless you, child. You have such potential. We should talk when this is over.
I glowered openly at Leah, who looked unrepentant. Okay, folks. The plan is going to be for me to stand where the fire is hottest. And if one of you gets cut off or goes down, I'm going to go back for you. I kept glaring at my godmother. Everyone who goes